I feel so often we are intimidated that the elite of the world have some kind of wisdom that we don't have. But you and I have wisdom that is from above. Because we know God, we fear God, we obey God.
Perhaps you have a project or a list of projects that you'd really like to get done. Organize the garage, for example, or lose the weight that you gained over Thanksgiving. Develop a new reading habit. Maybe you even have set one or two goals, but have never seen them come through at the very end. So how do you develop the self-discipline it takes to achieve goals? And more importantly, what does self-discipline have to do with your relationship with Christ and your love for others? Find out today on Grace to You as John MacArthur, president of the Masters University and Seminary, continues his series of lessons, Wisdom in Action, with a look at how you can honor Christ by redeeming the time. Here with today's lesson is John MacArthur.
It's brought home to me more and more all the time that many people never finish what they begin. There are unfinished symphonies. There are unfinished paintings. There are sculptures that have never had the finishing touch because in each case the master died. There are relationships that never become all that they could be. There are ministries that never really come to fruition. There are dreams that always remain dreams, hopes that always remain hopes, never become realities. And I guess for a lot of people, life can be an unfinished symphony. It can be a dream without a reality. It can be an ideal without a truth. But I don't think it has to be that way. I think there's one great reality that we need to focus on in the text that we want you to look at. Look at the 15th verse of Ephesians 5, and I'll read through verse 17. See then that ye walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. Wherefore, be ye not unwise, but understanding what the will of the Lord is. And we'll stop there. Now, you'll notice that there's a major statement made in three simple words in the middle of this text. It is redeeming the time. If we are ever to turn our dreams into reality, if we ever to turn our hopes into fact, if we ever to finish our symphonies and paint our paintings and sculpt our sculpture, it's going to be when we have redeemed time. I believe God has bounded our lives with eternity, and I believe God has prescribed before we were ever born the time that we were to live. And only as we maximize that time can we maintain its potential for fulfillment. You'll notice that it says in verse 16, redeeming the time. It is interesting to me how many times the Holy Spirit, when He talks about this concept of time, uses a definite article. The time. As if it is not some indefinite a time or some time or any time or times, but the time. God has almost prescribed times in very accurate and sovereignly determined doses. So God has given us definite time. In 1 Peter 1 and verse 17, there is a very important statement. If you call on the Father who without respect of persons judges according to every man's work, listen to the next line, pass the time of your sojourning in fear. The time of your sojourning. In other words, Peter is saying you have a definite set time bounded by God's sovereign choice. In Job 14 and verse 14, it says, all the days of my appointed time will I wait until my change comes. Job had a sense of an appointed time for living. In Acts 20:24, Paul says, neither count I my life dear unto myself. In other words, I'm not out for self-preservation. I have one thing in mind, and that is to finish my course. But it's most interesting in the Greek, the original language, it says, I am to finish tan draman emu, the course of me. In other words, it is the course that God has prescribed. And so we find that God has given us a time boundary. And within that time, he has defined a course. And Paul says, I want to finish the course and the ministry given to me, a specific time, a specific course with a specific ministry. In Hebrews 12:1, it says, let us lay aside every weight and run the race that is set before us. And the Greek says, the set before us race. In other words, it is a race set before us. It is a beginning and an ending that we can see. There is a boundary to it. At the end of his life, the Apostle Paul said in 2 Timothy 4:7 that he desired to fulfill God's will, and he could say he had. He said, I have kept the faith. I have finished my course. Only the word there is the course. The course. It's a bounded course. It's a bounded time. People, I really believe God has given us the time of our lives in sovereignty. He knows the beginning and he knows the end more. He has determined both. David had this tremendous sense of time and the urgency that time places on us when he cried out to God in Psalm 89, verses 46 and 47 with these words, How long, Lord? How long wilt thou hide thyself? Wilt thou hide thyself forever? Then he said, Remember how short my time is. In other words, in the midst of his distress and in the midst of his anxiety and in the midst of his pain, he had felt diverted from what he ought to be doing. He had felt distracted from what he should be doing. And he said, God, how long do I have to be off center? I only have so much time. The Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 7:29, this short phrase, the time is short. David said in Psalm 39 in verses 4 and 5, Lord, make me to know mine end and the measure of my days, what it is, that I may know how frail I am. Lord, please tell me how much time I have so I'll know how weak I am and I can really use the time I have. And then he further said in the next verse, Behold, thou hast made my days as a hand breadth, and my age is as nothing before thee. James put it this way. In chapter 4, he said, don't say, tomorrow we'll do this, and tomorrow we'll do this, and tomorrow we'll do this. For you know not what tomorrow brings, for your life is a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Now remember what we're talking about in Ephesians 5, will you? We're talking about the worthy walk, aren't we? How do you walk? Walk means lifestyle, manner of living. First of all, we learned in chapter 4, we walk in humility. Secondly, we learn we walk in unity. Thirdly, we learn we walk uniquely, different than the rest of the world. Fourthly, we learn we walk in love, chapter 5. Then we learn to walk in light, chapter 5. And now we're learning to walk in what? Wisdom. And what does it mean to walk in wisdom but to redeem time? Because that is the greatest squandering of potential. For Christ's sake, he says, for the sake of who you are, use your time wisely. Now let's back up and see how we're supposed to look at these three verses. A wise walking Christian knows three realities, all right? First, he has a sense of his life principles. Secondly, his limited privileges. And third, his Lord's purposes. Very simple, but very profound. First, a wise walking person knows his life principles. Walking in wisdom means you conform to certain standards of living. Now remember this. Wisdom is used here in the sense of the Jewish concept, not the Greek. To the Greeks, wisdom was something you spun off of your brain. Wisdom was an intellectual exercise. Wisdom was nothing more than unrelated sophistry. But to a Hebrew, wisdom was a living principle. That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about thinking. We're talking about living. And walking in wisdom is simply living according to divine principle. That's what verse 15 says. Look at it. See then, In other words, since you have been made alive in Christ, since you are awake from your sleep, since you have come into light from darkness, according to verse 14, since this amazing thing has happened in your life, see then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise. In other words, there are certain life principles commensurate with wise walking. See that you do that. You're not Sophos, a fool. You are Sophos, wise. So live it. So act like it. So walk in a manner in accord with your wisdom. And beloved, I would remind you of this, that when you become a Christian, immediately you become wise. And you become accountable for that wisdom. Did you know that we saw that Christ is made unto us wisdom? Do you remember Colossians 2:3 said, in him are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And verse 10 said, and you are complete in him. Listen, if Christ is all wisdom and all knowledge, and I am in Christ, then that wisdom and knowledge is mine in him, right? So from the moment of my salvation, wisdom is a part of my life. And Paul is saying, since you have become the wise, walk in wisdom. That's his point. Now, do you note the word circumspectly in verse 15? Circumspectly is the old English word that's used here. Walk circumspectly. Now, what it literally means is walk accurately, walk carefully, and walk with exactness. In other words, what Paul is saying is this. When you become a Christian, you don't just flip-flop and lollygag and stroll and mope your way through the Christian life indiscriminately doing whatever you want. When you become a believer, there is an exactness to how you are to walk. There are life principles laid out on this narrow path. You entered by the narrow gate, you walk a narrow path, and the word there means a compressed path. And if you're going to walk it, you got to walk it carefully. John Bunyan captured the reality of that in Pilgrim's Progress. By the time you finish reading Pilgrim's Progress, if you learned one thing, you learned you better stay on the way of the King. You better walk with exactness, and you better walk with accuracy and care. You can't just flip-flop in the Christian life. A wise man walks looking at every step. You know, if you read the second chapter of Proverbs, it's almost a commentary on this verse. If the Old Testament had been written after the New Testament, we'd say that Proverbs 2 is a commentary on Ephesians 5:15. All the way through Proverbs chapter 2, he talks about walking the wise path, walking the wise way, not going into the way of the wicked, not straying into the path of the evil people, but walking in the wise way, walking according to knowledge, understanding, and precepts of God. And so we are to walk in wisdom. That's very simple. And remember, wisdom is a synonym for living by divine life principles. Wisdom is a synonym for living by divine life principles. And you know, we live in a fool's paradise in our world, so it's not easy to walk in wisdom. The world is telling us all the time, do this, do this, trying to suck us off the way of the King, trying to pull us off the compressed and narrow path. And you know, the amazing thing about the world is the world thinks it's wise. The world thinks it has the wisdom, and the world looks at us and says, you're the fools, but it's just the reverse. Now, believe it, we were all fools before we knew Christ. But when we came to Christ, we became wise. Now, we're not the brightest people in the world, and we're not the noblest people in the world, and we're not the mightiest people in the world, but we are the wisest people in the world because God has given us His wisdom in Christ. And on the other hand, the world is foolish. You know, in Romans chapter 1, it describes the world in these terms. Because that which may be known of God is in them. They have the knowledge of God innately in them. But when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imagination, and their foolish heart was darkened, professing themselves to be wise, they became what? Fools. You say, what do you mean, John? The greatest fool in the world is the fool who says there's no God. And that doesn't necessarily mean an atheist. That simply means somebody who doesn't think God has any claim on his life. That simply means somebody who doesn't think he has to live by God's standards. That's the biggest fool of all. And when we come along and preach Jesus Christ, in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, we preach Christ, and what does it say? The preaching of the cross is to them that perish, what? Foolishness. They think they're wise, and we're the fools. They think they have the truth, and our truth is foolishness. But the fact of the matter is, we are the wise and they are the fools. And so Paul is saying here is, since you are the wise, walk in wisdom. What kind of reality would it be to have wisdom and walk as a fool? Makes no sense. Now let's look at the second point. Not only are we to be aware of the life principles, but the limited privileges. You say, you mean as a Christian my privileges are limited? Yes. Your privileges are limited in this time. In this time, it says in 16, redeeming the time because the days are evil. There are limitations on our privileges, people. If we don't walk wisely now, we don't have any other time. All we have is now. That's it. If I lose this moment, it'll never be back again. Redeeming the time. He's talking about opportunity here, by the way, because the word he uses is not chronos. Chronos is a Greek word which means time like a clock, time like a calendar, time like the sequence of minutes and hours. Chronos is the word from which we get chronology, the flow of events in history, or chronograph, something that keeps time. But the word here is kairos, and it means eras or epochs or opportunities. We are to redeem the opportunities, the moments that can be grasped for God and for good and for glory for Him. The Greeks had a statue, and the name of the statue was Opportunity. And in one of the ancient Greek cities, this statue stood in the very center of the city. It was carved and chiseled by a man named Lysippus. It had wings on its feet, and it had a great lock of hair in the front, and it was bald in the back. From the middle back, completely bald. And underneath the statue was a great base, and carved in Greek on the base was this dialogue. Who made thee? Lysippus made me. What is thy name? My name is Opportunity. Why hast thou wings on thy feet, that I may fly away swiftly? Why hast thou a forelock, that men may seize me when I come? Why art thou bald in back? When I am gone by, none can lay hold of me. Opportunity. The believer who walks in wisdom knows to make the most of opportunity. Now listen to me. I want to show you something interesting. And I've already hinted at it. Do you notice how Paul says walk wisely in verse 15 and then immediately talks about redeeming opportunity in verse 16. Why does he connect those two? Because I am convinced that man plays the fool with time and opportunity more than he plays the fool with any other thing. That is the greatest category of foolishness, the misuse of time and opportunity. I feel this is talking to Christians here. Remember what the psalmist said in Psalm 90 and verse 12? He said, so teach us to number our days. Why? That we may apply our hearts to wisdom. It is wisdom that numbers the days. It is wisdom that accounts the limited time. It is wisdom that buys the opportunity. Wisdom walking down that narrow path sees an opportunity for evil and shuns it because that's the fool's act. Wisdom sees an opportunity for good and grasps it because that's the opportunity for God. And even more important is it, as he says at the end of verse 16, because the days are evil. These are evil days. And if we're going to make anything out of an evil day, we're going to have to buy the opportunity. It's kind of like this, folks. What he's really saying could be seen in two or three ways, but first of all, look at it from this angle. You know, the days we live in general are full of evil. And what he's really saying is the opportunities for righteousness are few. The opportunities for goodness are few. In the midst of an evil world, when they do come, grab them. When God is giving you an opportunity for glorifying Him and in return bringing blessing on you, doing something for His name's sake, grab that in the midst of an evil day. Can you imagine what a heartbreak it is for God to create a world like our world and fill it up with every good thing? And when it's all made and done, He says, it's all good. And then to see the thing corrupted and debauched and made vile as it is today, as it has been since the fall of man, as it continues to increase in its corruption, can you imagine how it must be for God to see the days of the world that He made so filled with evil? And then to see a Christian who is given a golden jewel of opportunity after opportunity and after opportunity who bypasses it with never so much as a notice. The days are evil. This is an evil day. And God gives us those times and those opportunities to make things happen that matter, to fill up at least a moment of a day, an hour of a day, with something good, something righteous, something for Him. And so there's a general sense in which I see this. I see God, and I see His heart broken over the evil of a world that He made for His own glory. And I say to myself, if God gives me one little opportunity in the midst of an evil day to do something good and something to honor Him and something to glorify Him, I want to grab that opportunity, see? The days are evil enough. And it seems as though goodness is so few and far between that we need to take every opportunity. It's bad enough that my life is bombarded and inundated with evil influences that when one good one comes along, I want to grab that. But there's another way to look at it. It may be a more direct statement to the Christians who are reading this, who are living in an evil time. It may be a reference to the Ephesians who were living in an evil day. Their society was a debauched society. If you go back to chapter 4, you find, for example, in verse 14 that there were people going around teaching false doctrine. There were those who, using the sleight of men and cunning craftiness, were trying to deceive God's people. Satan had his false teachers. Satan had his harbingers of evil. Satan had the ones coming around masquerading as religionists who were propagating their lies that would damn men. Further, there was evil all about. It tells us in verse 19 of chapter 4 that the people of that time were characterized by lasciviousness, which is a perverted sexual desire. That there was uncleanness and there was greediness. This is the pleonexia. This is the fulfillment of sexual desire to the point that it's beyond any kind of rational thinking. Further, he says it's a day of lying in verse 25. It's a day of anger. It's a day in verse 27 when the devil has a place. It's a day of stealing. It's a day of corrupt communication. Chapter 5, verse 3 talks about sex sin, uncleanness, covetousness, filthiness, foolish talking, jesting, and so forth. I mean, it was a day of evil. And he may be making that major thrust and saying, look, redeem the time because the days are evil. He may have been alluding to the very hour in which those people were living. Persecution and distress was on the horizon. You know, it was only 100 years or so from this time that Christians were burned at the stake and Christians were thrown to the lions, and it was coming, and it was coming fast, and whatever they were going to do, they were going to do then. I'll tell you another thing. It was a few years after this, just a few years before the end of that first century, that dear beloved John the Apostle wrote to the Ephesian church and said, you have lost your first love. And you know something? If something doesn't change, the candles stick's going to be removed, the light's going to go out, and there'll never be a church in Ephesus. And you know what happened? They didn't change. The candle was removed. There never was another church in that city. Their time was shorter than they thought because of the evil of those days. And when the church at Ephesus fell under the spell of the evil, they went out of existence. And today, if you were to go to Ephesus, you know what you'd see? You'd see nothing contemporary in existence there. It's gone. The time was short. The days were evil. They fell prey to the time they lived in. You know, they realized persecution was coming. They must have. They knew what Jesus had said about the fact that they would be persecuted for His sake. I think a sense of urgency is necessary, people. I can't say for America what's going to happen to Christians, but I've asked God that if it's going to take something persecution-oriented to bring us to the place where we get a grip on what we ought to be, then let it happen. The urgency, people. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what the evil day brings. Maybe the most evil day of all is the day in which everything is so easy that we lose our priorities. Maybe that's the most evil of all. The church would thrive better under Idi Amin than it does under affluence in many cases. It's been true all through history, you know. The blood of the martyrs becomes the seed of the church. I'm not asking for that. I'm just saying that we sometimes don't understand urgency. We don't see the evil day because we are sucked into the system and the line is not clearly drawn.
You've been listening to John MacArthur as he continues the current study on grace to you titled Wisdom in Action, an in-depth look at how you can apply biblical truth to your day-to-day decisions. Now, certainly, everything John said today about time is also true of finances. We have a limited amount of money and the responsibility to use it for the glory of God. So, John, with that said, Grace to You often hears from folks who make spiritual investments with their money. What would you say is a common characteristic of these kingdom-minded people?
Well, it's clear that people who make wise investments with their time and wise investments with their money understand spiritual priorities. I mean, it really does come down to that. The people who make foolish decisions with time and money and other resources make foolish decisions because their priorities are wrong. It's absolutely critical that we establish our priorities. And I think the words of Paul are really helpful here. Paul said, make it your ambition to be pleasing to him, pleasing to the Lord. How can I please the Lord? What pleases the Lord? The proclamation of his truth, godly living, bringing the gospel to people, giving biblical instruction and sound doctrine, building up the saints. We know these things please the Lord, and that's where our time and money ought to go. I just remind you that these things are the things that drive Grace to You in this community and beyond. Grace to You exists to fulfill the will of God in the lives, first of all, of non-believers, to bring them the gospel so that they can be redeemed, and then, of course, in the lives of believers as we seek to edify them, to build them up in the truth to the fullness of the stature of Christ. As we get into December this year, we're reminded again of how critical it is that we receive the support of those who love and believe in this ministry. Your gifts, as we look at a brand new year, are going to make the difference. We're able to unleash God's truth one verse at a time on this radio station and others like it, broadcast on television, and literally distribute biblically based books, Bibles, and CDs free by mail all over the world, and post a huge variety of free resources on the website because of the support that you bring. What you do in this final month is going to launch us into the new year. And these last few weeks are absolutely crucial. Supporting Grace to You on a regular basis means everything to us. And even supporting Grace to You uniquely, as some do, in an estate plan is also a good option that helps us in the future. We have information on that on our website.
Friend, if you'd like to be a partner with us in this crucial year-end time period, and you'd like to perhaps consider a legacy gift that will support biblical teaching for many years to come, express your support as you get in touch with us today. Mail your tax-deductible donation to Grace to You, Post Office Box 4000, Panorama City, California, 91412. Remember, you can also make a one-time donation or set up a convenient recurring donation by calling us toll-free at 800-55-GRACE or by going to our website, gty.org. By the way, if you'd like to participate in the Legacy Giving Program here at Grace to You by naming Grace to You in your estate plan, your life insurance policy, or making a stock gift to make sure that generations to come have access to verse-by-verse Bible teaching, visit the Legacy Giving page at our website, gty.org. Or just call our toll-free number, 800-55-GRACE. That number translates to 800-554-7223. And thank you for your help in taking God's truth to folks all around the globe. On behalf of John MacArthur, our copywriter Blake Kenyon, and the staff here at Grace to You, I'm your host Carl Miller, thanking you for listening today. Remember to watch Grace to You television Sundays on DirecTV, Channel 378. And you can also watch online at gty.org. And then come back tomorrow as John continues his look at self-discipline, a practical topic with profound spiritual implications. Join us for that 30 minutes of unleashing God's truth, one verse at a time, on Grace to You.